This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, the future of the J.A. Douglas McCurdy Sydney Airport. He was the first to throw his hat into the ring for the provincial Liberal leadership. We'll speak with Labby Kazulis and a landmark show for the Highland Arts Theatre in Sydney. That's all coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. WestJet says COVID-19 is the reason it's pulled its flights from airports in Atlantic Canada, including the J.A. Douglas McCurdy Sydney Airport. That means a dozen jobs are gone. What does the future hold for the Sydney facility? Well, the airport's CEO is hoping it's only a temporary move, and if WestJet does return, Mike McKinnon says people should remember that old saying, use it or lose it. He spoke with Dialogue's Bill McCush.
It's eliminating about 100 flights a week. 80% of the seat capacity in our region, it starts November 2nd, and it's also, I think, dealing with Quebec City is having some impact as well. But primarily, this is an Atlantic Canada cut, and very concerning, obviously, for airports in Atlantic Canada. Not surprising, though, for us, because, you know, we're here living it, seeing it, and, you know, the problems in the industry, which are well-known and well-communicated to the government, but here we are 7 going on 8 months into the pandemic and still nothing is happening. Been happening to help out, if you know what I mean. We're looking for some assistance. Airlines and airports, we're all in the same industry, and we have not seen any help come from the government. And these are the things that happen. WestJet just cannot operate any longer. We're thankful here in Sydney. WestJet did, you know, up until this announcement, WestJet was continuing to operate and had operated throughout the pandemic, albeit the service level was reduced from daily service to just a couple of times a week. But, you know, there was a period of time WestJet was the only operator early on in the pandemic, and they were providing a vital link for people to get home and still for people to travel out west and things like that. But right now, it's just reached a point where traffic is, the demand for traffic is very low. We had a little blip there in the summer when people were doing some traveling, and the 14-day government isolation has been a huge detriment to travel into Nova Scotia. And then third-party fees that are increasing because of, airports and NAV Canada raising their fees coming up in January. All of these things are factors that have led WestJet to make this difficult decision. Now, I will say it is a suspension. We're told it's a suspension. So it's temporary. If things improve, they'll be looking at maybe resuming service, but you know, in the industry, we know it's very difficult to get service back once you lose it, and that's the challenge ahead. So, we're in for a bit of a lot of work going forward to see things improve.
So when it comes to whether or not this decision by WestJet is temporary, would that come down to factors whether or not keeping the COVID numbers at bay and government assistance?
Oh, absolutely, but I think the one thing that's been detrimental to travel into Atlantic Canada is the 14-day isolation requirements, which have in Western Canada, airports in Western Canada have seen traffic levels that are about 20 to 25% of where they were in 2019. Now that still sounds really bad, but here in Atlantic Canada, we're seeing traffic levels that are single digit compared to 2019. Many of the airports in Atlantic Canada are 90 to 95% below where they were last year. We're at 88%, and it's just simple math because we're a small airport and have lower numbers. But you can see that, you know, it's just a fraction of what you need to maintain operations.
What services remain there now at the airport, Mike?
Well, we have Air Canada. So Air Canada are operating 5 days a week to Toronto, a 5:30 in the morning departure, and that plane comes back in at 11:45 p.m. And they operate as well on Mondays and Fridays. They operate one flight to Halifax on Fridays, so it comes in from Halifax and goes back out at 4 o'clock to Halifax. And they have the same operation on Mondays, and that's it. Now, you compare that to where we would have been this summer. We would have had 7 days a week to Toronto, 7 days a week to Montreal, and four flights a day, or two Air Canada flights and two WestJet flights a day to Halifax. That's normal operations for us, and that was the plan for the summer of 2020. And, you know, right now you're only seeing WestJet, who are just terminating. They were only operating, or right now are only operating 2 days a week.
Is there an opportunity for Air Canada to step up on services with WestJet pulling out?
Well, I think there's an opportunity, but I don't think there's an appetite. And I think Air Canada feels the exact same way. They don't see the demand. The restrictions in place are depressing demand, and the increasing fees are also going to be detrimental to seeing service increase. You know, I'm sure they're looking at this and evaluating whether there's an opportunity. But you know, looking at WestJet's the passenger load factors they were carrying out of Sydney over the last couple of months. Take away the peak in July, August. It's been challenging for them, and I'm not sure Air Canada sees much of an opportunity there to increase yet. When things change, obviously we'll see service improve, but we're not seeing any indications that it's going to change in the near future.
For some of the passengers you may be losing who would likely drive to Halifax to save money on the price of a ticket, do you think a lot of people are aware of the benefits of flying out of Sydney when it comes to safety and spending money on the road, whether or not you run into weather where you have to pull over for a motel, of course the extra fuel charges and whatnot, and the safety measures of just avoiding any potential mishaps while traveling on the highway to Halifax?
Oh, absolutely. There are people who understand that, and for me, as the CEO of the Airport Authority, that's always been a bit of a frustrating point, that we know that the last time we studied this, that 4 out of 10 people who flew, who were actually residents of Cape Breton Island and were going to fly somewhere in 2018, 4 out of 10 would drive to Halifax to get on that airplane. And our job here is to try and educate people into the benefits of flying out of Sydney. You hit some of the factors that are important: the safety, the time that you save. And also, the fares were very competitive out of Sydney. In fact, on many routes, we were equal to and slightly cheaper than flying out of Halifax, which was frustrating because we would still see people drive to Halifax, even though it was slightly cheaper. This is back in 2018 and early 19. It was slightly cheaper to fly on some routes directly from Sydney. So there's a lot of reasons why people do drive. I think in some cases it's generational. We know a lot of young people who have the tools in their hands will fly from Sydney and would absolutely never drive all the way to Halifax to catch an airplane. And then we have some people, the more senior folks, and I'm one of them, but I fly a lot. But a lot of people still think it's expensive to fly out of Sydney. And unfortunately now, in the situation, a lot of these things are in the rearview mirror now, and going forward, we don't know what fares will look like. We don't know what service will look like. And I think until we get past this pandemic and, the elements of the new reality are already in play, the airlines and our airport, numerous things going on to ensure the safety of our passengers. And, from enhanced cleaning to social distancing to wearing masks to restricting access to the terminal, all of those things have been in place since late March, early April. And so many people who have flown and need to fly, they've seen the experience improve over time, and there's been no real concerns. But there are, elements of the population who just don't want to fly right now. And, it's going to be hard to gauge whether or not people will want to fly in the future, or maybe until we have pre-departure screening and testing that's basically rock solid. I think that might be the only solution that's really going to work, that you could get on an airplane, know you've been tested, get to your destination, and therefore not have to go into isolation because you've been tested. and establish that you don't have the virus. It's hard to say how that's going to play out. We've been lobbying hard through the CAC, the Canadian Airport Council, and with airlines like Air Canada and WestJet are also lobbying for things like this. So the industry is working hard. In many parts of the world, the industry is way ahead of Canada, and that's unfortunate. We're not sure why we're so far behind here with all of the information we're giving to the government to try and improve things, but that work continues, and hopefully we'll see something change soon rather than later, because the clock is ticking on the industry, in my view.
Before COVID-19 hit, do you think there was a use-it-or-lose-it type attitude for passengers, or do you think sometimes airports the size of Sydney, they're often taken for granted? And when it does become a safer time for the airline industry, is this something you and your colleagues might be able to address? If we don't use it, we will lose this?
Well, we've been saying that, and I've been saying that since I came to this airport, because I saw the data that showed so many people were driving to Halifax to still get on an airplane to save $30 or $40. So, the example I can give is Yarmouth Airport, where, you know, back when I worked in the airline industry, I worked for a company called Air Nova back in the mid-80s through the 90s. It became Jazz over time. We used to fly through Yarmouth on the way to Boston, and after a number of years, that service was dropped by Air Canada. And as the years went by, no commercial air service was at the Yarmouth Airport, and eventually the airport had to shut down and become basically a small airport now that just serves ambulances and military flights and private aircraft. Commercial service no longer exists on that part of Nova Scotia, so anyone down there has to drive to Halifax. You don't have a choice. Well, that could easily happen here in Sydney if the public don't support their own airport, and that's my fear, definitely my fear coming out of this as we try to recover. But that being said, you know, I'm encouraged that, you know, there may be opportunities for other airlines who previously might not have had interest in trying to serve some of the markets because they would have had to compete against the Air Canada and WestJets. Well, maybe some of these airlines might look to fill in the void. We've seen that happen in Newfoundland with provincial airlines who are now, you know, trying to operate some routes over there that Air Canada canceled earlier in the pandemic. And you know, that's probably the one bit of light down the tunnel, is those opportunities may bring new players into the market with more of a regional focus, and that might help improve some of our services.
And what's the morale like there, Mike, for the staff when they hear an announcement like this, and are any jobs affected?
Yeah, no, morale is, you know, you can imagine, you know, anyone who's in this industry knows and watches the huge numbers of, you know, layoffs at the airlines, and here at the airport we've had to do that, layoff people, and you know, this is 12 people who work for WestJet here at the airport who will be losing their jobs. I'm not sure how that plays out if they move, can, you know, have the opportunity to move to other airports. Obviously the you know, I think even Halifax Airport is shut down, or is planning to shut down the service to a very significant extent. So I think, you know, the prospects for people that are working here are, you know, if you're going to stay in the airline industry right now, it's going to be very challenging.
He was the first out of the gate and one of three saying they'd like to be the leader of the Nova Scotia Liberal Party and the next premier of the province. Former cabinet minister and Halifax MLA Labby Kazulis has a business background and paid a visit to Cape Breton recently. He spoke with Bobby Nock.
Well, I want to start off by asking you why you want to be leader of the provincial Liberals.
Well, it's the same reason I ran back in 2013. I felt I could make a difference. I wanted to come in, help Nova Scotia succeed. If you recall, back in 2013, we had our youth leaving the province by a record amount. Job opportunities were scarce. Our lobster prices were $3-4 a pound. And, you know, I wanted to come in, make a difference. And, you know, one of the things that I'm very pleased in our accomplishments is the investments we've made for vulnerable Nova Scotians. Our fisheries is thriving with our new markets that we opened up in China. And as well, for the first time, we're keeping our youth in Nova Scotia since 1989. And, you know, I know that's not quite the case in Cape Breton, and we have to focus on that to do it here as well.
Well, what did you learn from that first go-around at the leadership? What lessons are you taking into this campaign?
Well, there's no silver bullet. We can't do one thing to solve our problems. And, you know, when we want to tackle a big problem, we need to do multiple programs. We need to tackle it from multiple angles. And only that way will we get the results we want. If we think we're going to do one thing, 2 years later we find we didn't really move the needle that much, then we just wasted 2 years. So my approach would be to tackle our youth unemployment, jobs on multiple fronts with multiple programs. And that is a bit of what we've been doing in the last 7 years, and it has been working, but we need more of an emphasis in our rural areas.
Well, you've been in Cape Breton for the last few days. So yep. What have you learned in your time here?
The big thing is just opportunities, and people want opportunities for their children to stay here, for their children to start a life here. They're looking for good paying jobs, and it's really, you know, if you don't have a good paying job and you don't have a strong economy, then, you know, everything else falls apart beneath that. So I'd say the number one priority is, you know, give us the opportunity to have a strong economy and help us get there.
What are some specific things that a provincial government could do to help Cape Breton in those areas?
Yeah, so two areas. We're at the infancy of what could be a thriving IT sector here in Cape Breton. Mm-hmm. So we've seen success in companies already, Securacy, Procase, to name a couple. We can take that, leverage it for more success. And that would mean investment by the provincial government. So it would mean that we're supporting the companies with funding. We're supporting them in markets and getting their first customer. A lot of these startups, if they can get that first customer and get revenue going, then more funding follows. Because the way the industry works, a little bit of seed money gets them going. Then usually InnovaCorp will come in and make an investment. But then when venture capital money flows in, we're talking to the tune of $1 million, $2 million influx to really push that business. And what they also do is they bring expertise. They bring their contacts. So, you know, when you have a partner at that level, they're saying, you know, you have a product that we can sell to XYZ. Well, I already know people at XYZ. So we need to link the ecosystem here into the world market. And that would be just one aspect of what we could do. Another great opportunity here in Cape Breton is tourism.
Mm-hmm.
So just recently named the most beautiful island in Canada. We know from our own statistics, even off of the Nova Scotia ferry that links with the U.S. and Yarmouth, half the people come to Cape Breton.
Really?
So yeah. We need to this is a tourist destination for Nova Scotia. And what we need to do is expand it and now make it a year-round tourist destination, which we're starting with Cape Smoky.
And what are the plans for Cape Smoky? How do you make that a year-round?
Well, Cape Smoky is more of a winter destination, but now they're going reverse and looking at
making it a
summer. So the government, and this is where government plays a role, we had an asset. We weren't, you know, government doesn't run businesses or doesn't run them well. We put the asset into private hands, but we also tied development to that asset as part of the conditions of sale. So the new owner is making significant investment, which will bring tourists. I'm a skier. I will come there and ski. I've skied it before, even after it was shut down. I was up here with the government, and I brought my skis, and we actually hiked to the top and skied down.
Oh, really? Oh.
So now that it's going to reopen, you know, it's a beautiful area. The views are spectacular. And, you know, it'll be a tourist destination, not only for Nova Scotia, but possibly Canada. And as winter tourists, it allows us opportunity. There's a lot of people, there's a lot of individuals who in the winter do backcountry hiking, backcountry skiing, and that opens up that possibility as well.
And I think the private developer is looking at building a giant tower on that site too.
Yeah.
A look-off tower, I guess.
Yeah, which would be I mean, the view would be spectacular. So that would be another draw for people as well.
Now, something else, especially here in the regional municipality with the municipal election going on, something that comes up, almost every candidate brings it up, is equalization.
Yeah.
The conservative leader, Tim Houston, when he was here, he pledged to double the amount of equalization the municipality is getting. Where do you stand on equalization?
I stand on solving our problems. So if all we have to do is double equalization and our problems go away, let's just do it. But I will do the hard work with Cape Bretoners, which means making strategic investments that will create jobs, will create high-paying jobs, will keep our youth here. We have another opportunity to even, you know, we have a lot of foreign students here in Cape Breton. We need a way to keep them here long-term, because they will create jobs and opportunities and link us into one of the largest economies in the world. It's not a coincidence that when we increased our immigration, the amount of immigrants coming to Nova Scotia by tenfold when we came to government, that our unemployment went to the lowest level it's ever been. So, you know, we've seen it. We've seen how, you know, Sydney to me now, from where I've seen it before, is starting to thrive more. The businesses are full. Apartments are full. Money is circulating in the economy. And that is a direct result of CBU. So, you know, it'd be easy for government to hand out a check. It'll be hard for government to create the conditions for Cape Bretoners to succeed. I'll take the hard road.
Okay, so you're not committing to double the equalization?
I'm committing to working with Cape Bretoners, and it might be a larger investment than doubling equalization. So I'm committing to working with Cape Bretoners to make strategic investments so that we create the economy that our youth can work in, the economy they want to work in, because they don't want the jobs that I had, and to create the ecosystem where we can actually create industry and jobs. If we hand a check over, is that going to solve the problems? That's the fundamental question here. Are we actually, like, it'll allow the municipality to have a little more cash flow to allow them to do quite a bit. But if you actually break down the amount that Tim Houston is talking, it might work out to about, you know, $5 a month for each Cape Bretoner. And that is not that. And if it's just handing it out, that's not going to solve our problem. So I want to, and you know, if that's part of the equation, I'm not saying no to it. What I'm saying is I want to roll my sleeves up and do the hard work and get the environment here that we can actually all succeed. Because for Nova Scotia to be successful, all our areas need to be successful. This is the second largest municipality. And if it's not successful, we're hurting from Yarmouth all the way up here.
Now, you have two cabinet colleagues as your opponents in this race. What do you make of your opposition in this race, and what makes you a better choice than those two colleagues of yours?
We have a strong cabinet. There could have been a ton more in the race that would have all been capable. Your local MLA here, Jeff McClellan, is a very capable individual. He would have been a strong leadership candidate as well. We have others that, you know, could have entered the race as well. And that just shows the strength of our team overall, which has helped propel Nova Scotia, further. I bring a different background. I was a small business owner, and, you know, I was a small business owner where I actually, you know, signed my personal guarantee to the bank, and I knew if I didn't succeed, I'd lose everything. I was a small business owner where if, you know, the cash flow wasn't there, my employees got paid, I didn't. So I understand the stresses, especially during COVID, that our small businesses are going through. I've met with a lot of them here in Sydney. You know, restaurants are feeling the crunch. Other small business owners are feeling the crunch. Tourist operators are really feeling, you know, this past tourist season, because our tourists weren't coming here.
Because of COVID,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So that gives me a very large understanding of that. The other part of my career, I worked for 4 years in rural Nova Scotia. So I worked in Truro, I worked in Amherst, and I worked at Trenton Works down in Trenton in the New Glasgow area. Mm-hmm. my job in rural Nova Scotia was to help small businesses. And, you know, I had clients that were from dairy farmer, blueberry farmers, woodlot owners, you know, fishermen, you name the industry, and I had them as a client. So that gives me a perspective into the challenges in rural Nova Scotia and in urban Nova Scotia as well to help them succeed. And then if, you know, as I move back into other parts, you know, my education is a big asset for this job as well. And, you know, that's helped me move forward because although I was never an accountant except for while I worked at Trenton Works, while I was working in rural Nova Scotia with Scotiabank, lending and helping companies succeed, the bank put me through my CMA CPA program. So I did become an accountant as well. So all of that skill set combined, you know, gives me the tools to help all Nova Scotians succeed. And, you know, even my whole life, my parents were small business owners, had a restaurant. I worked there from a young age. I was so young, I was standing on milk cartons to wash dishes. But I kept working there, and by 18, me and my sister were running the restaurant because of other circumstances.
Yeah, you certainly don't have to stand on milk crates to do just about anything these days.
That was prior to getting all the gross spurts.
Yeah, it must be pretty young. Yeah. How would you, you know, if you do become leader, how are you going to be different from Stephen McNeil? What do we see that's different in a leader of and a premier? I guess.
I'm my own person, so you know I've had a great relationship with Premier McNeil. You know, we've accomplished a lot as a team, and I don't think anyone can take that away from us. But you know, with the way I was raised in my parents emigrated from Greece. I was raised in a Greek household under the Greek culture, which even growing up, I noticed was a little bit different than my friends, even though I was born in Nova Scotia. I bring my values to the job. I bring my my love of just people, and you know, I'm a very outgoing person and very social person. And you know, I actually thrive off of traveling around the province and meeting people and talking to them. I'm a very open. My door will always be open, and you know, I've had great relationships with our stakeholders. You know, I will just continue that and just continue having conversations. I'm my own person again, so it's, you know, it's anyone running is a different person, even though we're in the same government.
I think I heard you quote it somewhere that you felt you'd have perhaps a better relationship with, I don't know if I'm paraphrasing here, but perhaps a better relationship with Labour than the current Premier.
Yeah, I would definitely, I have a relationship with our Labour leaders now as the Minister of Labour, prior Minister of Labour, because I stepped down for the leadership. And prior to that, one of my ministries was the Public Service Commission, which was Human Resources. And I started developing relationships with them then. We've always had good relationships. We've always found common ground. Now, keep in mind, I wasn't on the negotiating committee that, you know, where we might have had our differences come out. But I think we can find common ground. I think we can work with that common ground. And then hopefully with an open door policy, we can work through our differences as well.
And there probably are going to be challenges in any upcoming negotiations because of the financial pressures of COVID.
There definitely is. And, you know, government right now, our deficit ballooned. You know, half of it is because our revenues weakened because, you know, we have, as of today, we have about 35,000 Nova Scotians who are not working that were prior to COVID. So, you know, we also have extra spending of about $400 million on helping businesses get through COVID. So we're in a very large deficit, and we have to be careful of that because we can't let it become structural. We need to make sure that we come out of it. And we will come out of that deficit because once a vaccine comes and the economy opens, we'll see people back to work. We'll see the economy getting back to where it was. And I do feel that, you know, this is not a structural deficit. but we got to make sure it doesn't become one.
So you'll be looking to, once things start to turn around, which we're talking months away at this point.
Yeah.
You'll be looking to perhaps rein in spending, cuts potentially, or
I'm not looking at cuts. This is manageable. Even at public service, when we had human resources, one of the things I was pushed very hard is, if we have to lay an individual off, that's management's failure. So we have to work. We have enough vacant positions that we have to work to make sure that person, if their job might be eliminated, but that doesn't mean we lay them off. We have to retrain them and move them into another position. So I'm not a fan of layoffs. It makes our workforce very nervous, and we need our workforce to be comfortable moving forward. And I went through this at Internal Services. We moved over 500 employees in and out of healthcare into government, vice versa. We amalgamated our procurement for all of healthcare into government so that we'd have a bigger spend, have more buying power. It worked. There was $50 million in savings in the healthcare system in the first year and a half. But when we were moving people around, there was an anxiety. And I said from day one, because I wanted people to be comfortable, you're not going to lose your job. You might move offices, or you might be with a different team, but you're not going to lose your job. And when you talk about Internal Services, this is it's about the fifth largest department in government. When I was the minister of it, it was a new department. It pulled in procurement. It pulled in IT for all of government. It pulled in accounts payable, receivables. It pulled in public works initially, but then that got moved back. We did it in a seamless way because we communicated, we worked with the staff, and made sure they were comfortable in what they were doing. And now during a pandemic, that is crucial that we make sure that all of the people who work in the province know that, we're not going to have massive cuts, layoffs just to get back to balance. We're going to get back to balance by putting the 35,000 people back to work, helping them transition, and making sure we don't have unintended consequences of our small businesses shutting down because of COVID when they're actually healthy otherwise.
Well, thank you for stopping by to talk to us today, and good luck with the campaign.
Thank you, Bobby. My pleasure, and thanks for having me here.
And finally on our show today, it's a landmark show for the Highland Arts Theatre. The Twisted Tail Little One will be the Hat's first performance away from its downtown Sydney home. Director Alison Crosby says this psychological thriller has the perfect Halloween setting, a haunted house in Whitney Pier.
So for people who don't know, what is the Highland Arts Theatre and what is its role in the arts community here in Cape Breton?
Well, the Highland Arts Theatre is the professional theater in downtown Sydney. It really filled what I think was kind of a gap in the arts community in Cape Breton. We really didn't have a theater hub in downtown Sydney. We had the Savoy and Glace Bay, but nothing really downtown Sydney. So I think it really filled a much needed hole in the arts community in Cape Breton.
The building itself is quite the landmark, isn't it? It was built in the early 1900s as St. Andrew's United Church, and so it's been around for a long time. And does that offer anything to the atmosphere for the productions that take place there?
Yeah, it's an absolutely beautiful building. Like, I often see people who are traveling from away, like, often we'll have Halifax-based theater artists come and see shows down here, and they're just in awe of the space. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. It doesn't look like any other theater I've really been in because, you have these huge ceilings and all of this beautiful architecture paired with, very brand new theater lighting and a huge sound system. So it's quite the interesting contrast, but it's an absolutely beautiful space.
It was mentioned somewhere on your website the theater itself is in a Gothic style. What exactly does that mean?
I actually don't know a ton about the architecture of the building in terms of style. I can say that one of my favorite aspects of the building is that it still has its completely intact and functioning organ from the original construction, which is very, very stunning to look at.
And to listen to it, too, so there you often get to hear music, someone playing that organ?
Not often. We usually have someone playing it at Christmas. I remember my first time doing Christmas Carol, they had an organ player come in, and that's how they did the pre-show music, and it was absolutely fascinating to watch. And, of course, there's also the bell tower, which is much more frequently used and still completely functional.
How would you describe the community of people who run the productions there, the actors, the singers, and the dancers? There must be a lot of talented people here that you work with.
There is a lot of talent here, and there's also a huge sense of camaraderie. There's a lot of, I mean, it seems silly to say, but there's a really strong sense of teamwork. The Highland Arts Theatre has a very ambitious season. You know, when you're talking 12 main stage productions a year, there's very few theaters who can pull that off in any capacity. And to see the Highland Arts Theatre doing it with such a small core staff is pretty amazing. So anybody that's working at the theater in any capacity, the artists there are so wonderful to work with because everybody just wants to work together to make something amazing happen.
And the HAT is a nonprofit, no government funding from what I understand. So how do you manage to keep doing the productions?
Well, I think Wesley could probably speak to that a little bit better than myself. I do know that their initiative for Radical Access was a huge turning point, especially after coronavirus came into the picture. Being a somewhat community-funded theater, you know, they've just about reached their goal. They're so close to reaching their goal for community funding, and that's a very novel thing in Canada, and the fact that they're pulling it off is really amazing.
And Wesley, of course, at the helm of the Highland Arts Theatre, can you mention who is Wesley and what's it like to work with him?
Wesley Colford, I have known since I was 9 years old. They used to actually teach me at a summer theater camp sometimes when I was really young. And then they went off to Toronto and went to school. And when the Highland Arts Theatre started, you know, just becoming a venue as opposed to just a church that was for sale, they came down to do one of their original musicals, the Wachowski Brothers, and what they thought was going to be a one-time thing became what the last 6 years of their lives have been. Wesley's probably the most hardworking person I've ever met in my life, and I'm really lucky to work with them as much as I do.
And what about the selection process for you and Wesley and the other people that you work with there when you're trying to decide what the next production will be?
When I'm planning a new show, I really love to work with people that I know share a common work ethic. Like, it's so much easier to work in a room when you know everybody is completely focused and completely on board. So that honestly does play a bit of a part, is just attitude and the way people work together. So, for instance, when I was casting Sweet Enough, Josie Sobel, Jenna Leahy, and Ron Williams are all people I've worked with before and have loved working with before. They all bring so much light and brilliance into a room and so many ideas that I get to just take and claim as my own. So I love working with people that are my friends as well as being extremely talented artists.
So how did you become interested in theater?
Yeah, I did start when I was 9. I was an extremely energetic child, and energetic is my way of trying to kindly say that I needed a lot of attention. I kind of never stopped talking, and so it was actually a cousin of mine that told my mother, like, you need to get her involved with theater, like, you need to channel this crazy energy somewhere. So I started taking classes at the Class X Drama School, just outside of other school activities, and the older I got, the more I just kept doing it. It never really was anything I intended on doing for a career, but it was just the thing I couldn't stop myself from doing with every spare minute of my time.
Can you talk about some of the projects where you were a writer, especially in Lieu of Flowers? You mentioned in an interview online that you imagined a snippet of what the ending of what the story would be, and then you built the entire story around what you had imagined. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. I I usually, when I'm working in Halifax, I'm mostly working at Neptune Theater, which is about a 20-minute walk from my apartment. And I think just about every idea I've come up with in lieu of flowers was just me walking to work and suddenly getting these pictures in my mind. And the first one for that show was actually the last maybe 30 seconds of the show, which I don't necessarily recommend starting writing a show with an idea for the ending, because it makes the rest of the writing process really strange. But yeah, I love that project, and I've really loved being able to work on that as much as I have.
What's it like having the responsibility of being a director?
Being a director is very interesting. You really are responsible for the room. I take it very seriously that I'm responsible for everybody's comfort level. I'm responsible for how everybody's feeling on stage. I never want to put somebody in a position where they're on stage and they're feeling overly vulnerable or they're feeling unsupported. So I try as hard as I can to make sure I'm creating an environment that people feel comfortable in. I hope I'm doing that. I'm always working harder to get better at that. But also it's interesting. You have kind of a lot of control over every aspect of the show, which is great in some ways. You have a vision for a show and you get to make sure the entire team is kind of going toward one vision. It's an extremely important role. But it can also be tricky. For instance, I'm not really a costume designer. That's not my forte. So when a costume designer comes to me and is asking really intelligent, detailed questions about the color palette for a character, it can become tricky because you kind of need to be, you have to have an opinion about absolutely everything. So you really have to put a lot of thought into all of your choices.
Is it important to trust skills and the talent of the people around you? As you said, the costume designer and the grips and the other positions when it comes to making a production like this?
Absolutely. If you don't trust your team, or if you don't feel like you're working with a good team, you may as well quit while you still have the time, because you have to rely so much on everyone around you. Nobody can do everything by themselves. So when you're directing, you really need to create a team that you feel confident in and that you can put that confidence into the room, because people will feel that. And if there's any kind of uncertainty or difficulty, the team will feel that and everybody suffers from that. So luckily at the Highland Arts Theatre, everybody is so on board and everybody is so committed to making sure that we're all making something worthwhile happen. So it's very rarely an issue at a place like this, but yeah, I think it's extremely important to have full confidence in your team. And when you do, they'll bring you beautiful things. At least that's been my experience.
And what do you mean, beautiful things?
I mean, I've asked some pretty crazy things of people here. And sometimes you come to people with half of an idea. For instance, Sweet Enough, I think I came to Kayla, who is our set designer and costume designer, and I said I wanted it to feel like a house that was only halfway finished. And I didn't mean in the sense that it was halfway through construction. I meant that it was literally half of the house and half of nothing. And she came up with this beautiful set that's like these two risers and this empty frame of a house that ended up being completely effective. But sometimes you just have to go to people with half of your idea and see what they can shape it into, because, more minds on something is always helpful.
Is it fun to watch the actors improvise if you do give them that license to do so?
Yeah, I think it's really important to let the actors bring a little bit of themselves into the role. They'll always surprise you in ways. I mean, I don't think there's a single rehearsal I've ever had at the Highland Arts Theatre in my life where I haven't laughed uncontrollably or cried uncontrollably or somewhere in between. I mean, it's so fun watching people interact with each other, bring their own ideas into something. And sometimes you're working on a scene that you think you know like the back of your hand, that someone will say a line in a way you never expected, and it becomes 10 times funnier than you ever thought, or 10 times more important, or 10 times sadder. And the way that actors can bring that out of a script is fascinating to watch.
We're coming up to the end of October, a special time of year that a lot of people are excited about, and there's a timely production coming up that you're directing for the Highland Arts Theater. Can you talk about that, please?
Do you mean Little One?
Yes.
Okay, beautiful. Yeah, Little One by Hannah Moscovich is possibly my favorite script of all time. I think I've been bugging Wesley to let me do it somewhere in Sydney for 4 years. And it's tricky because it's a challenging script. It's actually a psychological thriller, which is kind of, I think, an underrepresented genre in theater. So when Radical Access came about, Wesley had an idea to do site-specific theater or environmental theater, which is basically a piece of theater that's occurring outside of your usual stage space. So it's not happening in the theater. It is happening in a house in Whitney Pier that has not been lived in for years. It's stunningly dilapidated. There's all of these layers of like complex wallpaper. Some of it's coming off of the walls, and there's bare wood and bare brick, and it's honestly a little bit creepy to be in there if you're by yourself at night. But it's, I think, going to be the perfect Halloween show for anybody that's looking for something a little bit spookier and a little bit different than, you know, your standard show at the Hat that people have come to expect.
And you have the privilege of directing that. Is this the first time you've directed a production like this? It seems very unique.
It is actually my first time directing a show in a house, for sure. I have actually directed this script before. It was actually my fourth year thesis when I was graduating from Mount Allison University. But it's been so amazing to revisit the script and get completely new things out of it. And, you know, through discussions with the actors, find gem after gem in this really complex script. Directing in not a theater has definitely been a challenge, especially when we're considering social distancing as being part of that. It's a smaller space, so navigating that has definitely been a challenge, but it also offers all of these opportunities that you don't normally get when you have one audience in one space. You know, you can move people around, you can bring people from room to room, you can bring people into the space that you're talking about, and it's a really fun and different way of storytelling.
And it looks like it is, like you said, an ominous type story. I'm just looking at the poster for it here, where it mm-hmm. says Little One, and there's a candle with a small cat with a big shadow in the back, and it's very, very interesting. What can you say about the production without giving too much of it away?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely wanted to communicate with that poster that this is not your standard Highland Arts Theatre production. Beautiful poster designed by Hilary Scott, by the way, who's absolutely one of my favorite people to work with. Little One is the story of two adopted siblings, Aaron and Claire. And Aaron and Claire, although they were both adopted at the age of 4, lived very different lives up until their adoption. So Aaron kind of takes on this idea of being the epitome of quote-unquote normal as a child, and Claire struggles a lot more because she's been through a lot more. So Aaron is telling us the story of what it was like to grow up with a sibling who was suffering in that way, while Claire is telling us the story of their next-door neighbors, Roger and Kim Lee, Kim Lee being Roger's mail-order bride. And those stories seem fairly disconnected, but they really parallel in fascinating ways. And as these two people tell us these two stories, it is dark and it is extremely compelling.
And then you mentioned it being in the haunted house, an abandoned house in Whitney Pier, so that must really add to the atmosphere, I would imagine.
It does. When Wesley told me that they had found this building and we first went in for the first time, we actually went in, I think it was after a show for House this summer. So it was myself and Wesley and my partner, who is also going to be our sound designer, Jordan Palmer. And we were exploring this house with the flashlights on our phone, which really added to the spooky atmosphere, and which is why all of our shows are happening in the nighttime, because that also just adds another layer of this very creepy vibe that we're creating. And, I mean, to tell a dark story, to tell a psychological thriller in a house that by itself offers so much in the way of this creepy environment. I think it's going to be really cool.
Do you think there will be something different with the audience experience with because of COVID-19, I think there are only 15 members allowed, and the way you described the story that you told and it being in a smaller venue, will there be more of an interaction or more of a connection with the actors and the people who are going to see the production?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly going to be intimate, which I think is a really nice contrast. You know, it's part of the beauty of site-specific theater is you're brought into this new space and you're experiencing a show in a way that you haven't before. The audience will, of course, be 6 feet away from the actors at all times, but there certainly will be a sense of, you know, we're only 17 people and we're all in this small room together and we're all experiencing this story at the same time. I think it could be really powerful, and I hope it is.
It seems you'll have your hands full with this until at least early November, but are there any other projects you have on the back burner or something you'd like to maybe talk about that's coming up in the future for the Hat?
Sure, yeah. I'm currently the Highland Arts Theatre's first artist in residence, so there are going to be a few more projects that I'm working on with them. For instance, we have a couple of audio plays that we're going to be working on. Again, that's another aspect of Radical Access that I'm really excited about. But at some point I will be returning to Halifax for a little while. I'm going to be doing a couple of lighting designs in the city for a dance show and, much smaller shows because of COVID. But, I do have a few other projects on the go, and luckily I'll also get a little bit of time on my hands to finish some writing projects. I have one that I'm working on for the Highland Arts Theatre as part of their playwriting unit, which is called Irrelevant, which has been slightly neglected because of how busy I've been, but I'm really excited to dive back into that. If you want to buy tickets or if you want to find out more, you can go to highlandartstheater.com or you can call the box office, which is open 11 to 5, Monday to Friday.
And that's our show for this week. You can contact us at info@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.